fine. How are you doing?
Pretty good, thanks.
Good, good.
This is so surreal.
Yeah, it's a little weird when you're used to seeing me on that screen and now I'm actually talking to you, so.
I know, it's kind of nerve-wracking.
Yeah, it's a little weird at first, but you'll get over it. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
Well, tell me
Happy
a little bit
Easter, by
about
the way.
yourself. Go ahead.
Well, let me wish you Happy Easter, first of all.
Well, thank you, and happy Easter to you too.
Thank you. I enjoyed Freddie's rendition of Christ the Lord is Risen today.
I love it when he raps hymns. It's much better than when he sings them.
And the funny thing is that we had our own little mishap with that song yesterday in
Oh, really?
church. Yeah, so a friend and I were leading worship, and we didn't have that song in our set list. So we hadn't practiced it. We hadn't sent it to the person who does the PowerPoints. But we do two services back to back, and it didn't show up in the first service. But the second service, it suddenly showed up on screen towards the end. And we were trying to look at each other, and the pastor's like, beckoning us up. So, all right. So we just went up and played it. But you know how hymns can have anything from like 4 verses to 73 verses, right?
That's right.
And so we had no idea how many verses the person had put in. So we kind of thought we were at the end, and so we did the little, final slow strum,
Yep.
and then the person pressed the button, and the next slide came up, so we had to start again. And that happened a couple more times. So, but it was great. It was great. The whole congregation was laughing by the end. So,
Oh, that's wonderful.
yeah.
So you must be a worship leader.
Yeah. So I'm kind of in charge of setting the rota. I mean, that's pretty much all it is.
Okay.
Like your church, or like it sounds from what you've said, it's not the most glamorous setup,
We're
but yeah,
glamorous at Living Stones.
make a joyful noise.
That's right. That's right.
So it's an Anglican church, which is kind of cool. I didn't grow up in the Anglican church. But I've been worshiping there for the last 5 years since I got here. So
Wonderful. And where
yeah,
are you?
I'm in Morocco, in
That's right.
Casablanca.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. That sounds pretty
So
wild. Now, what brought you there?
I was actually born in Morocco.
Really?
My parents met here in the 70s and got married here, and my siblings and I were all born here.
Wow.
So we left pretty early when I was 3, and I grew up in Saudi Arabia.
Wow.
But then about and so I taught English after college. I taught English in a few different countries for a year or two, and then about 5 years ago, I decided to try coming back here. Get back to my roots. So,
Wow. What are you
yeah.
doing for work?
So I teach English as a second language
Okay.
and Spanish too.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
I've never been to
So,
Morocco. I'm gonna have to get there.
you should. Yeah, honestly, like, and I was thinking it. I've really enjoyed your videos and the conversations too, especially. If this does go on YouTube, this is like an open invitation. If anyone wants to come to Morocco, I'd be happy to, show them around and help them out if they come here. So,
I will tell my wife, since the Australia trip, my wife's had the travel bug. So I'll say, honey, you want to go to Morocco? We got someone to
yeah,
show us around.
definitely, definitely.
All right, I'll let her know.
So, I guess a little bit about myself. Well, I kind of already told you my brief biography. So as I said, I didn't grow up in the Anglican Church. My mom was a Christian and Missionary Alliance growing up, and my dad, who's from Scotland, grew up in the Church of Scotland, so very Presbyterian. So we grew up in house churches in Saudi.
Oh,
With other foreigners. So
interesting.
it was a really cool kind of experience, because it was people from all different denominations and nationalities. Had some Southern Baptists there, some Pentecostals from Brazil, some even Seventh-day Adventists. So yeah, it was a really kind of neat mix. So I would say that was kind of the background I was growing up in. The reason I ended up at the Anglican Church here is more just because there's not much choice for English language services in Casablanca. So when I first got here, I went to the International Protestant Church. Mm-hmm. But the day I arrived, the pastor was away, and it happened to coincide with Nigeria National Day or something. And there's a large Nigerian population there. Mm-hmm. So it was very Nigeria centric. So I was just kind of like, what is this? And so I was like, okay, well, I guess I'll try out the Anglican Church. So I went there the next week, and you know, people were very welcoming. And so I kind of just slipped into that community. It's actually a really cool church. It was built like in 1906, and it's where General Patton and his troops worshipped when they were stationed in Casablanca during World War II.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
But, yeah, it's really cool. So it's this tiny chapel. It's not that tiny. I guess it seats about, you know, 80 or 100 people, but that's crammed into the pews, you know, so.
Well, it's, you know, even in Santo Domingo, when I lived in Santo Domingo in the Dominican Republic, I spent most of my years in the Dominican Republic in Barahona, which is a small town. But in Santo Domingo, there's almost any capital city in any place in the world, there'll be an English language church or two. And they develop their own cultures, these churches. And I really love them. They're so... I mean, it's so interesting because you've got obviously people from all over the world with all of their different Christian traditions all kind of put into one space, and they have to be church together. And yes. I think there's something so beautiful about that.
There is. And it's funny too, you know, it's amusing because you can see where all the different kind of strains are coming in. Although it's Anglican, our priest, I guess, is what you'd call him. I call him pastor, but he's Egyptian. And, you know, we've got a large population of Nigerians and Liberians, Koreans, Filipinos, Australians, Canadians, Americans. So it's pretty cool. It's got its troubles, but...
There are always troubles.
Yeah. But, you know, one interesting thing with the whole... kind of Jordan Peterson movement and everything that surrounded that is, and you know, you've mentioned this too, young people kind of who are in the church getting back into sort of sacramentalism. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting that I kind of, you know, not intentionally entered into that kind of atmosphere before I discovered Jordan Peterson and Jonathan Peugeot and you, etc. So it was really at the beginning, it was kind of uncomfortable for me, you know, all the liturgy, like Lamb of God, have mercy on us, or Lamb of God, you take away the sins of the world, have mercy on us, grant us your peace, all that stuff. It felt kind of uncomfortable. But over time, I really kind of grew to like it. And as the pastor himself pointed out, it's kind of an interdenominational or non-denominational church with Anglican that kind of follows the Anglican pattern of services. So it's really kind of a cool mix of things.
Ah, it sounds delightful. When I was in Australia, so the church that all of the conferences that I did in Australia were held in was an Anglican church. And it was an Anglican church that quite intentionally continues the historic Anglican liturgies, as opposed to many of the other Anglican church in Australia that have sort of gone the way of contemporary Christianity in America and a lot of these other places. And I told the pastor, because he kind of feels a little, you know, all by himself in that, I said, there's a wave coming. And it's going to be liturgy and sacraments and stuff that you can touch and stuff that you can taste and things on paper that you read. That's very big in California. And when we started doing church plants, they were mostly the big sound contemporary kind. And they've all gone to weekly communion, more formal liturgy, so on and so forth. Living Stones is kind of the exception, but we're really exceptional in so many ways that we're it's just different at Living Stones because we're every group of people has to worship via their zip code and the unique mix of people that are there. So,
right. Yeah, it was, I went to the church synod for our archdeaconry a couple years ago. And that was in southern Spain. And, you know, it was all those communities were sort of older retirees who live in Spain and go to Anglican churches there. So it was much more traditional, the services that we had during the synod. And for me, it's still, that's kind of one step too far. You know, like I really like Jonathan Peugeot's videos and I really appreciate the symbolism. That really appeals to me, that kind of thing. But I'm still more comfortable. I'm still more at home with the kind of Anglican light, you know. I've been meaning to ask you, what took you out to Sacramento? Like from, I know you grew up in New Jersey and you went to like Calvin College or Calvin Seminary. How did you end up out in Sacramento?
Well, when we came home from the Dominican Republic, we needed to do something else. And in the Christian Reformed Church, there aren't any bishops in the Christian Reformed Church. And so churches are kind of independent brokers. And when a church doesn't have a pastor and they're looking for one, they search. And I was actually, this church was vacant, as they call it in our nomenclature. And they were interested in my father because someone who had been an interim pastor here said, oh, Stan Vanderclay would be good for this neighborhood. But my father was 4 years from retirement. And they had bought a condo in Massachusetts on the East Coast. And my father's like, my father was very high in openness. He'd like, California sounds like fun. And my mother's like, my mother's not high in openness. She said, oh, fun. You can go alone. And he wasn't about to go alone. So then he said, why don't you talk to my son instead of me? And so that's how they found me. And I actually had two offers, one to a church in Chicago and one to this church. And I very, very much felt the call to this church. This church had some important similarities to my father's work. It was an inner city work. A lot of folks from the African American community, but always kind of a different church. It wasn't a standard church for white folks or CRC folks or black folks. It's kind of an alternative church. That's what my father's church was growing up, and this church was too. So it was a good fit for me. And I felt very home at here right away. And so I've been here. It'll be 22 years this summer.
Wow. Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I love California. I love Sacramento. It's, you know, it's a great place to be. Raised my kids here.
I lived in Redding for a year.
Oh, really?
Yeah. My sister and brother-in-law opened up a business out there. They're no longer there, but I was with them when they opened up the business. Not the biggest fan of Redding, but...
Well, see, the Central Valley is this big dugout canoe, basically. And Sacramento is right by the Delta. So it gets hot during the summer, but at night, the Delta breeze comes up the Delta and cools Sacramento. So at nighttime, it'll get down into the 70s. It'll be comfortable. You get to Redding or Fresno or Bakersfield, cook.
It was awful.
Yeah. Really awful. So I wouldn't. Sorry for any listeners in Redding or Fresno or Bakersfield, but I like Sacramento because it cools down at night, even in the brutality of the Central Valley summer.
Yeah, they had they owned a convenience store, and you know the chocolate was literally melting on the shelves when the air conditioner went out. So well, if you don't mind, let me tell you how I kind of discovered Jordan Peterson and how I got into this whole.
I'd love to hear.
Yeah. So, basically a couple of years ago, I was visiting my brother and his family, in New Zealand, and he played a clip for us of Camille Paglia, talking about the collapse of Western civilization and how this had happened before. I don't know if you've seen that clip. But it really struck me, and I was like, wow, that's really, insightful. And so he suggested to me that I watch the Rubin Report. So when I got back to Morocco that January, so this is a couple years ago now, I started watching the Rubin Report. And so as the YouTube algorithm does, it eventually put up Jordan Peterson in my recommended list. And so I think I actually saw some like small clips of his, but they didn't really strike me immediately. It was watching the Joe Rogan podcast, the first one that he did, which I think is where a lot of people first got on board.
Gateway for Peterson.
Yeah. So I didn't watch it when it first came out because I didn't know about the podcast. But I think it must have been in February of 2017. And I think like pretty early on, you know, after about 6 or 7 minutes, I had that eureka moment. And it was when he was, I think it was that early on that he was already tying together postmodernism and Derrida and yep. Marxism.
Yep.
And I'm the kind of person who loves to find connections in things and kind of have, you know, this unified theory of everything. Mm-hmm. So although I kind of understood each of those ideologies or movements, you know, superficially on their own, I hadn't understood how they tied together. And here was this guy very eloquently and persuasively bringing them together. So, this may sound strange to non-Christian listeners, but I wasn't used to hearing wisdom of that sort, the way he was talking about it. Intelligence, certainly, you know, on any variety of topics, but a lot of the things he was saying, and not in that particular instance about the Marxism, but later on, the way he was talking, it just had such wisdom. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't used to hearing that kind of wisdom about life from non-Christian sources. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, that may make me naive or not well-read, but it was pretty...
No, I think that's a great point, because I think that's a big piece of why Christians have been drawn to him, because he has articulated Christian wisdom. Mm-hmm. And I think he's articulated it extraordinarily well in a way that Christians identify as Christian, but yeah. also better than most Christian leaders have done.
Yeah. And one thing that really struck me about him too, is his humility. You know, I really like that. He's always pointing out his own flaws and his own weaknesses. And I think this is also what appealed to a lot of, what made him sort of the gateway drug to Christianity for a lot of people, is his humble approach to epistemology, you know, and how open he is about not knowing. I actually commented to that effect in a recent Rebel Wisdom video, because it struck me that certainly in my own case, like I won't speak for all Christians, but in my own case, I could tend to be dogmatic at times. Mm-hmm. I think not necessarily because I was so convinced in every instance, but because I was worried of you know, not having answers for people, and then people taking that as a loss in the debate, mm-hmm. or what have you. Mm-hmm. So it was really refreshing to you know, to hear his complete humility in not knowing things. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what drew a lot of people to him that would not be drawn to traditional Christian pastors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I really appreciated that about him. And so I kept watching various clips of his, but it was mostly, you know, interviews and short clips, pretty much through the summer. And then that fall, it wasn't until December, I think, that I discovered his biblical series, which he started in May, I think. So I discovered his biblical series just before I discovered you. because I started listening to them, and then I was kind of thinking, man, what am I supposed to make of him as a Christian? You know, like looking into the Bible in this psychological way. As you put it, he's coming at it from below rather than above, sort of God number one rather than God number two.
Yeah.
And the way he was talking about it really, you know, touched or struck a chord with me.
Yeah.
But I was kind of like, shouldn't I be able to get every truth that I need from the Bible or from within the church, like, how is this happening?
Mm-hmm.
And so then I actually looked for, you know, Christian takes on Jordan Peterson, but your video came up, you know, Christian pastor talks about Jordan Peterson. I was like, yes, this is what I'm talking about. So, and the rest is history. So, so that was back in, I think, December of 2017. So I pride myself on being within your first 1,000 subscribers.
Oh, I remember you, and I knew you lived in Morocco. I just wanted to get the stuff in the video. So don't, because you were an early one in, and I can't always keep track of all the names, but because you had a very interesting story and you were from Morocco, and I thought, how on earth is someone, because this whole thing, YouTube thing, was just a big, you know, what's happening? Someone from Morocco is listening to me? I thought, what kind of crazy is this? So
yeah. And I'm not the only one either in Morocco.
No, you're not. I noticed that, because then I noticed, oh, Google tells me where people are listening. It's like, there's more there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've had not formal, but informal Jordan Peterson meetups here.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Well, so I started something called the Socratic Club, kind of after what C.S. Lewis did, I think, or what the English did at Oxford. And I invited along a bunch of friends, about half of them Moroccan and half of them foreigners. And at that time, when I first conceived of it, I think I was the only one of us who kind of knew about Jordan Peterson. But over time, either through my telling people about him or people discovering him on their own, more and more of that group sort of began to get on board with Peterson. So
interesting.
Yeah, so it's really fascinating.
Wow. That's amazing. That's amazing.
And you know, it was so cool to discover your videos as well, because that's the great thing about the internet, right? It draws together, obviously has many terrible things about it, but it draws together communities of people who love the same things and who would not otherwise necessarily find each other.
Yep.
So especially to find someone talking about Peterson from a Christian perspective, and C.S. Lewis, who's, you know, by far my favorite author of all time, it was fantastic. So I really enjoyed that. And so I wanted to take this chance to thank you. And I deliberately waited not to put it at the beginning, because I knew you might edit that out of humility. So
I don't edit anything. I'm in too much of a rush to edit anything. But thank you. You're very gracious.
I do really appreciate it. especially the conversations, which, you know, is kind of surprising, because it's not the kind of thing that you would necessarily imagine you would enjoy, just listening to two random people talking online. But I think you're very good at listening, which I'm sure you picked up as a pastor, among other things. And so I think, you know, the great thing about that is that it allows people to kind of shine, and you're able to draw out, you know, what people might not otherwise have drawn out of them. It reminds me of what Peterson said about there are no dull people, only what stupid listeners, stupid interlocutors who think that they're dull.
There's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah. And also, I think, was it in Mere Christianity that C.S. Lewis mentions that about you've never met a dull person in your life.
Yeah.
Every person is a creature who, if you could see their eternal soul, you would either fall down before in adoration or flee from in terror. So
yeah, that's a great line. I used it in my sermon yesterday.
Oh, good. Nice.
Yeah. No, and you're right. And that was, for me, a surprising, I mean, like this whole thing for me, I've just kind of stumbled into it. And then, you know, started, you know, why not post conversations if people agree to it? What is it with two randos, you know? Why would anybody want to listen to two people just talking? And then I thought, That's exactly what YouTube, I mean, YouTube should be paying me. I'm not going to monetize my channel, but YouTube should be paying me, because this is exactly what YouTube is for.
And yes.
And one of the things that I've always, what I always noticed as a pastor too, is that God, just like 2 Corinthians says, he deposits in his glory in jars of clay. And as a pastor, you meet, you know, part of the reason, you know, we do the Freddie and Paul show is because I want, some people might look at Freddie and think the world would be better without him, or Nancy, or Phil, who's on sometimes on, or anyone else who comes on. And it's like, no, no, no. Human beings are amazing creatures. And if we can slow ourselves down and shut up the internal voices, we can see the glory of God shine through. And yeah, so to the degree that that happens on my channel, I'm just grateful.
Yeah. So that reminded me of The Weight of Glory, which, yeah. Oh man, that is definitely my favorite Lewis piece, I think, nonfiction piece.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask what yours is. I imagine it's miracles, because you often refer to that. Do you have a favorite nonfiction?
The Weight of Glory has to be up there. But my problem in picking favorites is I usually fall in love with the last thing that I look at, which is probably a flaw in my character. I love the book. I use the book Miracles a lot because I find myself always susceptible to materialist reductions. Mm-hmm. And miracles helped me. I listen to materials once or twice a year. It helps me resist some rather simplistic reductions that Lewis just sort of exposes in that book. But The Weight of Glory just sings. One of the things I noticed about Lewis, and Audible has a really nice collection of Lewis essays, which I think I bought it for something like $5, and it's like 72 essays or something in Audible form. There's amazing essays, but he often recycles his stuff. So the grand miracle in the book Miracles, which actually is in a bunch of other of his things too, is just an amazing story where Lewis talks about the incarnation as the missing chapter in history. And that for me is a go-to chapter of Lewis's.
Was that where the quote came from that Sherry brought up the other week about the hunter? Was it from that chapter, or was that a different one?
I don't remember if it's from that chapter, but that quote on pantheism also is something that Lewis used in a number of different essays. Yeah. So Lewis has these elements that, as anybody anybody who does a lot of this for a living, you have certain go-to things. That's one of Lewis's go-to observations. Yeah. And I also found that. So I, you know, in California, I'm always, you know, I try to maintain my Christianity. As a pastor, I really should. But so, you know, what are the things talking in my ears? I mean, one is materialism and one is pantheism. And so I'm always dealing with those two noisy riders. And so, you know, our elephants are herd animals. And so that's how we're influenced. So yeah. Lewis is very helpful on both of those topics for me.
And you know, one of the, I hear what you're saying about the sort of the go-tos and the interweaving. You know, you see the same threads in his other work. And I don't know if you've ever listened to Louis Marcos's great courses on C.S. Lewis.
No, I didn't know there was one. Oh my.
Yeah. And it's been out for like, I don't know, 15 years or something. I discovered it back in college 15 years ago. It's just a 12 lecture one. But part of it is called, or maybe the whole thing is called, Smuggled Theology. And I really like that because, you know, as I was reading through more and more of Lewis's nonfiction, the older I got, the more I discovered where all these themes in his fiction had come from. You know, it was these philosophies and theologies he'd been working out over the years. So for example, Till We Have Faces is, you know, it's the perfect encapsulation of the four loves, which if you listen to Louis Marcos's, he actually talks about it.
That's I bought it, so keep going.
Yes. Well, so I won't ruin it for you.
I used an Audible credit for it. It's like, yeah, that's definitely worth an Audible credit.
Oh, yeah. No, it's good stuff.
No, keep going.
So the quote that Sherry brought up, so I just finished Miracles about a week ago. For the first time, so here's the crazy thing. You know, I've been reading Lewis my whole life, And you know, he's always been my favorite author. I just love everything he's written, but I didn't always have access to his books, you know, being in various places around the world where you don't have English bookstores. Yep. And so there were a few of his books that I hadn't read, Miracles being one of them. And when I got here about 5 years ago, I'd read everything else that I read up to now, but not Miracles. And someone gave me a copy of it. And I started it at the time, but the first couple chapters are very kind of dense and, you know, the sort of the mathematical or logical side of philosophy, which does not appeal to me. And so I was a little disappointed. I thought, oh, this is going to be a different kind of Lewis book than anything I've known to date. So I put it aside. But after watching your videos and hearing you bring up Miracles so much, I decided about 3 weeks ago or a month ago to try it again. I'm glad I did because, yeah, it's like right up there with Weight of Glory. It's amazing. Yeah, yeah. And so the quote that Sherry shared with you, which I loved, it was also like one of my favorite quotes from reading it. But right before that, let me just read something and see if you, so it says, "You've had a shock like that before in connection with smaller matters, when the line pulls at your hand, when something breathes beside you in the darkness." Now, does that "something breathes beside you in the darkness" remind you of anything from Narnia? Remember in The Horse and His Boy?
Yeah.
Shasta's going over the mountain pass.
Yes.
He just hears this thing breathing beside him in the darkness.
Yes.
And I love
it. That's one of my favorite that's about the only passage I remember from that book.
Oh man, that might be my favorite Narnia book, along with The Last Battle.
Really?
Yeah, maybe because I grew up in Saudi Arabia. Might have something to do with that. But I love, you know, reading Lewis's fiction and discovering things from his nonfiction or vice versa. And I know about, over a year ago, I recommended a book to you, but I know you have an insanely long reading list. And so I don't know if you got around to it, but have you read Planet Narnia?
I started reading it. It hasn't grabbed me yet, but I bought it and I started reading it.
No, Paul, you got to read it. I know he's very kind of, he's overly academic at the beginning, and that is his like less accessible version. And it can be kind of off-putting. I know some of his language, but you got to get through it because I think it will convince you. I started off reading it as a skeptic, but someone who wanted to discover more of Lewis's genius, and by the end, I was completely sold on the theory.
Well, I've got a little trip with my wife this weekend, so maybe I'll bring it. I've got it on my Kindle and I've looked at it, but I'm such a passionate reader, and what I mean is that I read what I'm passionate about in the moment. It's such a bad thing, but it means that I've always got all these books going at the same time. But when something really grabs me, then I just do the whole thing. So well, I'll take that'll, you know, your recommendation just, you know, pushes it up the hierarchy a little bit more. And
I already had the utmost respect for Lewis, but when I read this book, it just like, it skyrocketed. And like, I don't know, I think it's criminal how underappreciated he is in the academy compared to what he should be, you know? And goodness knows, you know, I love Jordan Peterson and I think he's a genius. But honestly, I think Lewis's intellect dwarfs anyone that we have with us today.
Lewis. No, you're right. And I feel the same way. Lewis. And such a weird, you know, one of the books I read not too long ago was a biography of Joy Davidman, which was really interesting, both in terms of learning about her, but also learning about Lewis through her.
Mm-hmm.
It was a whole nother side of Lewis.
Was it disquieting?
Yeah, but it was more human too, because there's a tendency to, you know, to sanctify Lewis too much.
Right.
And
I definitely have that tendency.
Yeah, and Lewis was a dude, and he was a weird dude, and You know, I get that sense of Jordan Peterson to the April Q&A, and he comes on and, you know, hello. I just watch him on those Q&As. I just laugh. He's such a quirky dude, but I love it. I love it. And I got the utmost respect for him, and I'm not taking anything away. And, you know, part of it is because my whole family laughs at me. When I die, my family's just going to be telling, you know, all kinds of weird things about me. So,
my brother got into Jordan Peterson somewhat. And I think my father has enjoyed some of his stuff. I think my mother watched part of one of his videos and she said to me, I don't like him. To each their own. But coming back to the sort of the planets in Lewis, because it's not even something I really, despite having read the Space Trilogy, it's not something I noticed until I read Planet Narnia. And he makes like a watertight case for the planets representing the seven medieval planets as they were considered back in that time. But it also kind of, for me, it points to this bigger theme, I guess what Nick would call an axial possession, which I really like that phrase of his. Mm-hmm. In Lewis, that has been really hitting me more and more in the last 4 or 5 years. And that's the idea of sort of the tension between, you know, the Neoplatonic and the Aristotelian, the word becoming flesh, you know, and we so many of those dualities. And I think that had kind of started to grip me even before I discovered Peterson. But like when I started watching his biblical series, that just kicked it up a notch. And actually the month before I discovered your videos and the biblical series, I started writing a novel.
Really? Cool.
Yeah. No, don't get too excited because it's a very, very slow work in progress. But
doing it is good.
Yes. And well, now that I've put this out here on the internet, now I'm kind of, you know, accountable for it, I guess, which sucks. But
there are many unfinished novels in the world.
Oh, yes. I don't know if you've heard of NaNoWriMo.
Yes.
Okay. So a friend of mine here mentioned it to me and mentioned that she was going to do it, and she kind of challenged me to do it. And this was just a week before that November of 2017, I guess. And so, you know, I've always wanted to write a novel like everyone has. And so a couple days before it was due to start, I kind of started thinking, oh, well, you know, what could I write about? And a painting and a poem came to my head that I've always liked since college. And so I kind of decided to base something around that. So there's this poem by Auden, W.H. Auden. And it's about a painting of the fall of Icarus by a Flemish painter from the 16th century. I think from Antwerp or something. But the cool thing about it, and this is what the poem comments on, is that the fall of Icarus is not the central thing in that painting. It's just kind of off in a little corner while the farmer is plowing his field and a ship is sailing on. And so it was kind of a comment on how suffering just goes on in this world. You know, it doesn't take front and center. But so I really liked the theme of hubris, you know, of trying to reach the gods, you know, of Icarus flying up and getting too close to the sun. And Daedalus told him, don't go too close to the sun or it'll melt the wax on your wings. Don't go too close to the sea or the water from the waves will weigh them down and you'll drown. And so at the time I kind of saw it as a commentary on Aristotle's golden mean, because I'd been gripped with the kind of the paradoxes in life and finding that middle balance. Kind of walking that tightrope between the two. And so I started with that, but it kind of, without my meaning it to, it morphed into this idea of the word and the flesh, you know, of the word becoming flesh. And so, you know, the verse about unless a seed falls to the ground and dies, it will not abide, kept coming to mind. And of course, Lewis in Miracles talks all about that, which I didn't discover until this month. But so hearing about kind of order and chaos in Peterson really brought that to the forefront too. And so I like Nick's phrase of axial possession, because until now I would have called it a paradigm shift. Mm-hmm. And it is a paradigm shift, but I think with a paradigm, you're kind of seeing the world through these new lenses. But with an axial possession, it's like you see it everywhere. Mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm, where mm-hmm. The paradigm, like if you wear glasses, eventually you stop noticing the frames. Mm-hmm, and that's mm-hmm. kind of the case with a paradigm shift for me. But with an axial possession, it's just like you see it everywhere and you can't stop seeing it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I started seeing this tension in everything. And reading through a book called The Story of Philosophy, I got to Nietzsche, and he's talking about the Apollonian and the Dionysian. So again, you know, you see it there. And there was another beautiful phrase in the book.
Who wrote The Story of Philosophy?
Will Durant.
Or is that Will Durant's book? Okay.
Yeah. So that's a really good summary of philosophy. It can kind of drag it.
Interesting guy.
Sorry?
I said Durant's an interesting guy. I mean, when you look at his volumes of history.
Yeah. Well, and I didn't know any of that until I just, you know, I was looking for kind of summaries on philosophy. Right. And that was highly recommended. So I ordered it from Amazon. And then only after reading it did I discover that he'd written these tomes on history.
So. Tomes is right. My wife bought them. It's like, honey, I'm going to need some bookshelf space. Like, you're going to read those? Well, I don't know. I thought, they look nice on the shelf. And I started reading his ancient history one. I was like, oof.
Yeah.
Exhaustive.
Yeah. Yes. So it was a really good book. It took me about a year and a half to get through. but there was this one line, I think he was talking about Spinoza. And he said he had the northern hunger for truth rather than the southern hunger for beauty. Hmm. I thought, oh, that's so cool. Yeah, that's totally, that's exactly what Europe is, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hence the Protestant Reformation. But, you know, of course, the beauty of the Italian Renaissance was all in the South. And so, again, this was one of those dichotomies or those dualities that I was seeing everywhere. And so I just began to be really fascinated with that. And so that kind of led me to Joseph Campbell and The Hero with 1,000 Faces. Have you read that?
That's another one of these books that I'm about fifth of the way into. And it hasn't totally grabbed me. It was somebody at my meetup is always perpetually annoyed that Peterson doesn't give Joseph Campbell, doesn't say Joseph Campbell's name enough. And, you know, Jordan, are you not wanting to fess up to, you know, a lot of dependence upon it, but it could be that Peterson isn't dependent upon Campbell, but he simply has been marking similar things, because that happens sometimes. I get accused of that. Somebody once wrote me a big long thing. Why don't you give Jung enough credit? It's like, I haven't done any work in Jung. Everything you talk about is Jungian. Well, maybe you're seeing a lot of Jung in what I'm saying. And, you know, is gray. I didn't read it in a book.
That's exactly it. You know, like, I'd been starting to see all these dichotomies or these dualities and several years ago. And it was only kind of in the Peterson talking about order and chaos that started to come together. And then reading about Nietzsche and his Apollonian and his Dionysian. And of course, you know, you get that in Lewis to a degree. I can't remember where he talks about it other than in miracles, but he does bring up the sort of, you know, the Father Sky and the Mother Earth and that sort of symbolism. I wanted to talk a little bit about that hideous strength. Have you read that recently?
I have not read it recently. I read it when I probably read it 40 years ago. And so haven't thought about it a lot. And Luke Thompson keeps nagging me. I've got to read the Space Trilogy again. And I do, but it's in competition with a lot of other books on the hierarchy.
Worth a reread for sure. Cause there's a scene at the end of that Hideous Strength where the planets come down in bodily form. Right. So again, it's C.S. Lewis's obsession, you know, as an amateur astronomer, his obsession with the planets, and the fact that, you know, in classical mythology, they each had these attributes and these characteristics. And it's, for me, I think this is something I just recently recognized, but that even in that scene, again, it's this idea of the Word becoming flesh. You know, and of course, in that story, it's about this, the main character's nemesis is this department at the university that is doing research, and they have this disembodied brain, you know, and so I see that again and again in Lewis, and it's really fascinating. So anyway, I'm trying to work all these things into my novel.
Cool.
But it's a very slow process. So
I think it's great you're writing a novel. I think that's terrific. And keep it up. There's a few other people that I talk to that are working on novels, and I always encourage them to, you know, it, because at some point you want your novel to see the light of day, and you're going to want to see as many people to see it as possible. So you're going to have to give thought to how you're going to move up the hierarchy of the great I, which is popular awareness.
But on the other hand, there's two things I wanted to bring up about that. I saw a video, I think it was on the Rubin Report, where Peterson talks about writing, and he says, don't have an ideology and then just paste a story over top of it, right? Because that's just propaganda.
Yeah.
So when I heard that, I was like, oh yeah. Like, because, you know, I have this idea like, oh, I have such cool ideas about the Word becoming flesh and et cetera, and how to tie that in with art and what was going on in the 16th century in Europe and the Reformation. Because it's sort of a historical fiction. But you know, I don't want to propagandize. I want it to be, and that's partly why I read The Hero with a Thousand Faces, because I wanted to feel kind of more imbued with these archetypes. Mm-hmm. And just be able to have that kind of flow naturally.
Mm-hmm. I think actually probably writing fiction is helpful in making sure that doesn't happen, because if, you know, listening to the story of Lewis and Narnia, Lewis tried to write Narnia for a long time and it just didn't go anywhere until Aslan kind of popped in and pulled the whole story through with him. Mm-hmm. And good fiction is like that, in that if you keep working at this, at some point the story should take on a life of its own and it will get disconnected from you. It's you're still doing it, but it's a little disconnected from you. And I think that's where, you know, real art comes from.
Yeah. And that's my concern, is that I'm worried I have too much of the Apollonian or the Word and not enough of the flesh, you know, that I'm too obsessed with it. Oh, this is such a cool idea. I got to put this into the book, and, you know, trying to work it in instead of just letting, a story flow. But one other thing that came to mind was that, you know, I had been agonizing over like, oh, well, would this be considered literary? You know, would it be, because I don't want it to be a potboiler, you know, I want it to be kind of well regarded and I want it to be written well. But a friend of mine brought up the point, you know, I mean, which is a very simple and it's a point, it's something we've heard before, but don't write for for critics or for an audience, write the book that you want to write, or, yes, or create the art that for yourself.
Yep.
So I'm trying to keep that in intention.
Well, and keep writing. I mean, one of the things, so I've had some experience in training preachers, and what usually happens is people who want to preach, they've got like one sermon pent up in them. And now a sermon's a lot smaller than a book. And so they get up there and they usually it's a mess, because the death of a sermon is almost always way too many disconnected ideas. And so they kind of get up there and they vomit out that one sermon that's been in them for years. And then it's like, then it's on the stage. You just sit there and, you know, you pick through it a little bit and find a few good things. And they say, okay, write another one next week. And they're like, what? What am I going to say? It's like, but it's by doing, and it's by doing repeatedly that actually a lot of this stuff gets worked through and worked out. So, you know, you write this, and it might be just always constant rewrites. So you write a chapter and then it's like, well, that sucks. And then you rewrite it. Or, I mean, it's torturous. It's torturous business, but it's holy business too. And so, you know, that's why Peterson is dead on right. And that's why I tell people like, well, I want to do this. Well, then do it. Well, no, I want to think about it. No, just do it. And as you do it, I remember when, so my wife studied Spanish. She got a degree in Spanish before I went to the Dominican Republic. I had high school and college Spanish, but I didn't learn a darn thing. And I went to the Dominican Republic, but we had this little language learning class before then. And the guy said, in order to learn a foreign language, you have to make a million mistakes. So you might as well get started. And so I just butchered the Spanish language horribly. And my wife was just horrified at it. And it's like, hey, look, I'm making my mistakes. And so have at it and keep at it, and don't, you know, wrestle with it until it blesses you.
Yeah. I mean, language is definitely one of those things where you're not going to learn it just by learning the theory or the grammar. You have to make those mistakes.
Yep.
And from having had to learn several languages throughout my life, I've definitely discovered that the thing that motivates me is finding those funny kind of idioms or slang that's going to make the locals crack up, you know, and then like say, oh, wow, you're so, you know, we all need affirmation, you know.
Yep.
Those things kind of keep me going in trying to learn a language. So, but definitely you're not going to learn those things, or you're not going to be able to get them out without making tons of mistakes. But yeah, it's hard for me to apply that to the writing process. You know, I'll go whole months without writing, because I'm like, oh no, I don't like the thought of just word vomiting out on the page. You know, I go very slowly and I want the sentence to be just right. So I gotta
you're one of those.
Yep, afraid so.
There are word vomiters and there are editors, and I'm definitely a vomiter, so, which you can tell from my videos, because it's all just vomit.
Keep vomiting. We enjoy it.
Well, we have just a couple minutes left. Anything you wanted to get in before?
I mean, most of the things would probably take half an hour, but...
We can talk again.
Yeah, we can talk again. Maybe just like... I was going to ask you about Owen Barfield's theosophy and how... I know you're planning on doing a video on that at some point anyway.
I'll vomit that stuff out at some point, because I haven't. So someone, see, what happens is that I start doing videos, and then a whole bunch of people, because we have this natural desire to colonize each other. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's a million people that want to colonize Jordan Peterson, because that's the way this stuff works. And so there's only about 100 people who want to colonize me. And many of those 100 people have people in history who have colonized them, who now want to colonize me. So there's a whole bunch out there of Jung, and there's a guy who's using Owen Barfield, and there's others using Nietzsche. And so, but lately, and so then there's this hierarchy in my head, and Barfield rose up the hierarchy pretty quickly last week. And I read some stuff, because I've been rereading The Fellowship, which is a book that I make in my videos. If you want to see what's colonizing me, just watch my videos, because it's what's in my videos. And
I'd actually never heard about Theosophy until you even mentioned it in the context of Barfield. And I still don't know anything about it, except that I just looked up the definition. And it kind of struck me that, you know, like in Voyage to Venus, Lewis has his main character, Ransom, have this experience at the end that's sort of like, you know, Campbell's pantheism and what I imagine Theosophy would be. So I was going to ask you, you know, what's the difference there? And just something to keep in mind for our next video, if we're able to chat again, is like, I know Lewis often talks about the, you know, being brought up into and unified in Christ, but yet retaining that which makes us individual, and that being heightened instead of being dissipated.
Right.
And so my like I kind of instinctively agree with him, but I don't know why. And I'm wondering like what the theological explanation is behind that. So I know you don't have time to answer that.
Tell you quickly, because our Redeemer is our Creator, and it's creation, fall, redemption, restoration. And that's why our redemption is actually, you were created. And it's amazing thing within history. I mean, what history does and time does is creates, there are archetypes, there are patterns, but there's also individuality. There's no one like you. I mean, it sounds like wisdom you get from a purple dinosaur, but it's true. There's no one like you. And so God's redemption of you is both Christ and you. And so.
Yeah, I think I need to. have a longer video on that, but
yeah. And you know, Rudolf Steiner, my wife teaches at a Waldorf school. The Waldorf schools are all the legacy of Rudolf Steiner. And so I've got some experience with the Steiner community, and Lewis had zero respect for Steiner and that community. And so now, gosh, we're running out of time. It's really too bad. But so you've got a guy like Steiner, and you've got a guy like Jung. I mean, Steiner and Jung are coming up in the same stream.
Okay. I've never heard of Steiner, so I'll have to look into
it. Yeah, look up Rudolf Steiner. There are whole communities that continue to be devoted to him, as was Barfield. And so part of Lewis and Barfield, they had the Great War, and part of what was involved in the Great War between Lewis and Barfield was Barfield's fascination with Theosophy and Rudolf Steiner. And Steiner has a lot of really interesting, cool ideas, but Lewis saw it as, well, we'll have to get into that at some point. So,
Jung
is in there too.
If Lewis ever read Jung at all, do you know?
I have in my Logos Bible software, that's a great thing for managing books. Lewis mentions Jung in his letters. So I know Lewis read Jung, but he doesn't talk about him much. And I wish he did. So that's after we die. And we have access to C.S. Lewis and infinite amounts of time. We can talk about Lewis and Jung. We can talk to Lewis about Jung. So, oh boy. Let's see. Yeah. And further up and further in. I mean, and we just get little chances now to talk. And what we're doing is seeding conversations. This is why I can't.
It's all in Plato, Paul. It's all in Plato. What do they teach them in these schools? What do they teach them in these schools? Right?
Oh, it's so delightful. I have to hang up because I don't want to step on the next guy's time.
No problem. It's great talking, Paul.
This has been so much fun, Andrew. We'll have to do this again.
Me too. Thanks, Paul.
God bless you. Take care.
You too. All right.
Bye-bye.